The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, my name is Naomi Lambert from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will share articles with you from The Assembly, which publishes in-depth reporting on North Carolina at theassemblync.com. Well, you may recall that last week I promised to finish up an article about some officers from Orange County who were being charged in relation to a prisoner death. So they had waited to go and check on the prisoner, Mr. King. Both officers told investigators they suspected King had been assaulted, with Barry adding that he looked for injuries when he entered the cell because somebody could have hit him in the face. Linster told Barry he wanted to determine whether King had been assaulted because I don't want to accuse nobody of something they ain't done. Grants was charged with involuntary manslaughter and later pleaded no contest to that charge. He was sentenced to a maximum of 2 years and 8 months in prison. Along with the officer's disclosures, Richardson noted Berry's conflicting timeline around when he retrieved an inhaler for King, who had a history of asthma. Surveillance video showed Barry with the inhaler before he entered King's cell. But Barry consistently claimed that he only got the inhaler after going into the cell and King asking him to retrieve it. The officers have argued that they made a good faith, though slow, effort to help King and did not immediately realize the extent of his injuries. But Richardson dismissed that argument based on their conflicting accounts. The Fourth Circuit's ruling sends the case back to the U.S. District Court for trial, but the defendants could appeal the decision. Right, starting our fresh reporting now, this is a politics and government piece. Ethics panel recommends censure for Representative Chuck Edwards over inappropriate conduct. And this is an article by Jenna Monin. The U.S. House Ethics Committee recommended censuring Representative Chuck Edwards on Monday, citing his alleged inappropriate relationship with staffers. The committee concluded there was substantial reason to believe Representative Edwards violated House rules related to sexual harassment and hostile workplaces. The committee wrote in a press release about the North Carolina Republican. The committee's report found that Edwards engaged in persistent, unprofessional, and inappropriate conduct towards two young female staffers. Edwards, 65, who has been married since 1980, has denied that the alleged conduct was intended as a sexual or romantic advance. Sources told Notice in May that the House Ethics Committee launched an investigation into allegations that Edwards had an affair with a former staffer who left the office earlier this year. The staffer in question was Edwards's former deputy chief of staff, and she was initially hired as a legislative assistant to Edwards when he was a state senator in 2021. The committee issued a public request in April for anyone to report information about House members or staffers engaging in sexual misconduct. Shortly after that announcement, the committee was informed of allegations regarding Representative Edwards's conduct towards women in his office and began confidentially reviewing the allegations, the committee wrote in its 25-page report. Edwards was aware that his conduct towards the staffers had generated discussion and rumours in his office, according to the report. Representative Edwards also went beyond norms of professional behaviour by giving both women lavish gifts, the committee wrote. Both women received numerous gifts from Representative Edwards, including jewellery totalling over $1,000, designer purses, guns, shoes, flowers, a laptop and a cell phone. KitchenAid mixer, robotic vacuum, vacations, tickets to performances, and one-on-one dinners. One of the staffers said she felt obligated to wear a necklace Edwards gave her, and the congressman told her he was disappointed when she did not wear it. The report catalogues instances of alleged inappropriate conduct with the staffers, including the congressman paying for spa treatments, discussing going to strip clubs in D.C. and directing one of the staffers not to notify Edwards' scheduler about a dinner the pair had planned. Edwards brought one of the staffers to a holiday event at the White House and told her he wanted the night to be perfect. The congressman allegedly pressured the staffer to continue the evening with him and asked her to travel to and from the event in his car with his driver. Edwards told the committee he did not recall pressuring her that evening, but he acknowledged traveling with her to her home in Virginia because he felt uncomfortable dumping a young lady on the street. The congressman skipped House votes to decorate a Christmas tree with one of the staffers, according to the committee. He also went to that same staffer's house to perform chores like yard work, pick her up and drop her off for events and activities with his driver. The committee found that Edwards wrote poems for one of the staffers, including one that he read at her going-away party in the congressional office, accompanied by a slideshow, during which he cried. Multiple staffers testified to the committee that the incident made them feel uncomfortable, and Edwards said he recognized the discomfort among his staff. A censure serves as a public condemnation of a Congress member's behavior. The committee will bring Edwards' censure for a vote by the full House. This is the first time the Ethics Committee has recommended censure since it took action against former Representative Charles Rangel, a New York Democrat, in 2010, over improper fundraising, financial disclosures, and failing to pay taxes. Our next article is from Business and Economy. It's called Nipped in the Bud, and it's by Jeffrey Billman. Until last Monday, North Carolina's $3.2 billion intoxicating hemp industry seemed likely to live to fight another day. Sure, businesses faced a federal ban on most of their products that is due to take effect in November. And in early July, the NC Senate passed legislation to ban those products under state law too. But while the federal ban would create significant obstacles for hemp companies, it wouldn't necessarily run them out of business. And hemp advocates think it might be delayed or repealed. The state ban was the potential industry killer. But House Republicans declined to vote on it before the legislature's July 4th recess. Many insiders believed the bill would continue to languish when lawmakers reconvened this week for the General Assembly's likely final votes before the November election. There was too much dissent within the House GOP. That dynamic changed when the NC Sheriff's Association, the State Bureau of Investigation, and other law enforcement organizations sent a memo to House members last week endorsing the Senate-passed legislation, according to legislative and industry sources. With many lawmakers wary of defying law enforcement, the House could approve it as early as this afternoon. We're hearing from a Republican side that it's really the law enforcement thing, said Riley Dunn, a co-founder of the hemp beverage company Groove Wagon and a leading critic of the bill. It's making it a lot tougher for Republicans to have the cover to not do something. A spokesperson for House Speaker Destin Hall said he wants the House to vote on the bill, but that the decision ultimately lies with the majority of the Republican caucus. Hemp supporters scrambled to respond to the law enforcement groups, cultivating breakthroughs in healthy development. An industry advocacy group sent House members a dense 6-page memo urging them to vote against the bill. State members of the Hemp Beverage Alliance planned a rally at Tap Yard, a Raleigh beer garden, on Monday afternoon, followed by a lobbying event at the General Assembly on Tuesday morning. Apotheca Cannabis Dispensaries announced that it would close its more than 50 North Carolina stores on Tuesday so employees could make their case to lawmakers. This is not a choice between allowing shady gas station vape weirdos to make a bunch of money versus child safety, Dunn said. That is a false dichotomy. The law enforcement memo framed the decision exactly that way. It accused those who opposed the state Senate bill of wanting to sell drugs to children and said that failing to pass it would mean that anyone, no matter their age, will continue to buy intoxicating THC products from any retailer that wishes to sell them without legal consequence. As the Assembly detailed in its recent investigation, North Carolina currently allows sales of cannabis products with 0.3% or less of the psychoactive compound Delta-9, tetrahydrocannabinol, with no regulation or oversight. It doesn't prohibit the sale of hemp products to children, require child-resistant packaging, mandate lab testing, or monitor products for contaminants. Public health officials have linked this free-for-all to a spike in cannabis-related hospital visits. The only people and businesses who would oppose this bill are those who are profiting from and promoting a business model that thrives on selling intoxicating substances to North Carolina's children, the memo continued. At best, that's hyperbolic. Many hemp retailers voluntarily limit sales to those over 21, and the industry has been lobbying lawmakers for age restrictions and other regulations for years, in part to avoid a crackdown. The law enforcement memo also misleadingly assured House members that bills containing very similar language have already passed both chambers. In 2023, the State House unanimously passed an industry-supported bill that included age restrictions and testing requirements, but it died after the Senate tacked on a provision creating a medical marijuana program in North Carolina. House conservatives couldn't stomach it. But the current proposal, which can't be amended because it emerged from a conference committee on lawmakers from both chambers, does not regulate hemp. It bans almost all hemp products, including many that aren't intoxicating, from being manufactured or sold to adults in North Carolina. It could also leave many of the hemp industry's 16,000 workers unemployed. Its language mimics the federal ban, with both prohibitions scheduled to take effect on November 12th. But in late June, Russell Vought, director of the White House Office of Management and Budget, asked Congress to postpone or revise the law to ensure the fair treatment of hemp products. On July 22nd, U.S. Representatives Andy Barr of Kentucky and Angie Craig of Minnesota introduced bipartisan legislation to rescind the federal ban and instead regulate hemp. The White House has endorsed similar proposals. That means North Carolina might pass a law modeled on a federal ban that never takes effect. If that happens, North Carolina would have one of the most restrictive cannabis positions in the country, despite public opinion moving in the opposite direction. It's already one of only seven states that completely ban both recreational and medical marijuana. Of those, only Idaho bans hemp products, according to the Baker Institute for Public Policy at Rice University. Governor Josh Stein's Advisory Council on Cannabis reported in April that North Carolina has the country's second largest illicit marijuana market, worth more than $3 billion. The council recommended regulating cannabis without distinguishing between hemp and marijuana, and suggested that an adult-use market offered the best way to address regulatory gaps. Its final report is due in December. Stein acknowledged in a June interview with the Assembly that the legislature is unlikely to legalize marijuana. "What I'm trying to do is advance the conversation," he said. The hemp ban's prospects this week aren't clear. Some House Republicans support the industry, and others worry that language in the Senate-passed bill could create a backdoor way to legalize medical marijuana if the federal government approves it as a prescription drug. Two industry sources told the Assembly last week that they thought Hall might try to pass the legislation with Democratic support if he can't get enough Republicans on board. Demi Dowdy, a Hall spokesperson, said he would not bring the bill to the floor without the support of a majority of Republicans. A source close to House Minority Leader Robert Reeves II said Hall's office hadn't reached out about the bill, and Democrats planned to caucus on the issue on Tuesday morning. Internal emails obtained by the Assembly indicate that the industry believes Stein will sign the bill if the House passes it, though a spokesperson said the governor has not made a decision. As a potential vote nears, the fast-growing hemp beverage sector has ramped up its last-minute lobbying blitz. Dunn sought out friendly law enforcement groups to counter the Sheriff's Association. On Friday, Law Enforcement Action Partnership, a national organization that promotes drug reform policies, responded to the Sheriff's Association in a letter to Hall, which Dunn said he hopes to get to the Speaker on Tuesday. The letter pointed out that the State House overwhelmingly passed a bill last year that restricted hemp purchases to those aged 21 and up. The Senate's Rules Committee, chaired by Senator Bill Raybon, who was also a member of the conference that authored the proposed state ban, has not brought it up for a vote. Law enforcement experience has taught us that prohibition is not an effective public safety strategy, the letter said. Instead, it creates new enforcement burdens that divert resources without reducing harm. In addition, about 80 THC beverage makers, retailers and other business owners signed a separate letter asking the legislature to reject the bill, arguing that THC drink sales have rocketed while alcohol's popularity is falling. It noted that almost half of the state's craft brewers make THC drinks, and national grocers like Lowe's Foods and the Fresh Market sell them. Our strategy has really been not so much to separate ourselves from the broader hemp folks, as much as it is to make it really, really clear that we are only speaking to the people who are using drinks in 21 and up environments already, Dunn said. You're not just banning the sketchy vape shops or the gas station gummies. You're banning the Total Wines, the DoorDashes, the Fresh Markets, and all of the local brands who've been doing this business. Our final article today is from the health section. New work rules could drop thousands of sick NC residents from Medicaid. And this is by Joanne Kennan. For nearly a year, North Carolina health officials prepared for new federal rules that would require roughly 730,000 residents with Medicaid health coverage to verify that they are working in school or engaged in certain other community activities. Congress included the new work requirements for the Joint Federal-State Health Insurance Program for Low-Income People in last year's One Big Beautiful Bill Act. The rules apply to people in the Medicaid expansion created by the Affordable Care Act, which North Carolina adopted in 2023. The change does not affect people covered under traditional Medicaid, including those in nursing homes. Like most Democrats, Governor Josh Stein's administration disagrees with linking health care to employment when the legislation passed. Stein predicted it would be a crisis, a devastating loss, but to comply with the federal law, state health officials had to begin contracting vendors and putting plans in place for when the rules take effect on January 1, 2027. Then on June 1, federal officials unveiled a complicated, nearly 400-page rule detailing how states should handle work requirements that is far stricter than Washington had led states to believe, particularly for people who are too sick to work. These medically frail recipients will need a doctor to verify every 6 months that they still can't work. It can be hard to get timely medical appointments in parts of the state, and transportation, childcare, and other hurdles can make it challenging for people living near the poverty line to get to a doctor. Beyond that, people with chronic health conditions may have good spells and bad spells, and physical job requirements vary widely. Doctors say it could be both time-consuming and difficult to assess whether someone is able to work in the next 6 months. Federal officials have opened the door to states creating algorithms to help with these judgments, but it's not clear how that would work. State health officials and advocates now say they fear tens of thousands of North Carolinians could lose their coverage because of the burden of the new rules, and that the sickest could be hit hardest. Manat Health, a consulting firm that works on Medicaid, estimated that 289,000 people in North Carolina could lose coverage by fiscal year 2034, 64,000 more than they had forecast before the rule was released in June. NC Medicaid Director Melanie Bush told the Assembly that the people who need exemptions because of severe illnesses are also the ones who will face the highest barriers to obtaining them. We're all just trying to figure it out right now, real time, she said. People with children under age 14 who are pregnant or who are pregnant are exempt from the rules. Bush said roughly a third of the people on Medicaid expansion coverage in NC already work, while another third are engaged in community activities that meet the requirements. The remaining third are medically frail and unable to work. For the first year, the law allows people to self-attest about their health status, which will ease the transition, but that is temporary. North Carolina is one of 25 states with Democratic attorneys general or governors, as well as Washington, D.C., that recently filed a legal challenge to the new rules. The suit claims the rules are both unworkable and in violation of the wording of the beautiful bill law Congress passed a year ago. The Trump administration has defended the work rules. Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services Administrator Dr. Mehmet Oz has often said the law will save Medicaid from excessive spending, fraud, and abuse. If you can work, you should get up and work again, he told reporters at a White House briefing last month. North Carolina's Republican Senator Tom Tillis cited the sweeping changes to Medicaid as a broken promise when he announced last year he would not seek a third term, but has supported some form of work requirements. Neither his office nor that of Republican Senator Ted Budd, who voted for and has praised the legislation, responded to requests for comment. Medical frailty. Many people on Medicaid expansion have jobs, and the state will often be able to document that with tax and employment records. Others will have to provide their own documentation or prove that they qualify for exemption. People in treatment for substance abuse are exempt, as are people granted exemptions from work rules under other government programs like Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program or Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. Being in school, including trade school, serving as a caregiver, or doing steady volunteer work also fulfill the work requirement, though some of those activities can be hard to verify. Some health experts worry that people on Medicaid who are working will lose coverage anyway. Bryce Stanley, a health economist at UNC Wilmington, who has researched mental illness and disability, said policymakers may not have understood the administrative burden Medicaid recipients could face in documenting their employment or proving that they're exempt. That challenge, he said, can really lead to a lot of people that would otherwise either qualify or be exempt from requirements to end up losing coverage. That's what happened when Arkansas experimented with work rules in 2018. Problems with apps and internet access, among other things, meant that many of the 18,000 people who lost coverage shouldn't have. Arkansas has begun a soft launch of the new national program, hoping to spot and remedy problems before full implementation in January. The One Big Beautiful Bill Act included plenty of requirements, but seemed to give states space to make some of their own decisions on implementation. Both Democratic and Republican-led states expected to be able to rely on medical records to determine which Medicaid patients are too sick to work. Now they are scrambling to put different systems in place by the end of the year. Work capacity assessments can be complicated. Medical conditions aren't static. People with a serious mental illness may function well for several months and then they don't. Someone with cancer can feel strong enough to work at times, and very sick at others. Two people with a similar orthopedic injury can recover at very different paces, and of course, some jobs are more strenuous than others. Experts say these assessments will also likely cost the state's Medicaid program more money, even though one major rationale for the law was savings. This will require folks to have another doctor's visit, said Bush, the NC Medicaid director. Doctors are going to bill Medicaid for this assessment that they are going to be doing. Further complicating it, the federal government hasn't given doctors necessarily the right guidelines for making those assessments, she added. If you're too sick, well, you're going to have to jump through hoops to show that you're too sick, said Rebecca Cerise, interim director of the Health Advocacy Project at the North Carolina Justice Center, a liberal policy organization. It won't affect just doctors and patients. Processing the findings of those twice yearly checkups, then updating patients' eligibility and exemption status will add work for county social services offices. That's going to be a big challenge, and that's also going to be the biggest expense, Bush added. Keeping coverage. If many people lose Medicaid coverage, it's likely to have ripple effects throughout the state, particularly in rural areas with high rates of enrollment. People, whether or not they have health insurance, are going to get sick. they're still going to seek care, Bush said. It's going to be uncompensated in our hospitals and our clinics, and that's going to drive the overall cost of healthcare up for everyone. Some community advocates are coming up with creative approaches to keep people covered. A group of volunteers in the Greensboro area is trying to build on a similar effort they undertook with SNAP food assistance, which now also has a work requirement. Retired pediatrician Jane Foy is working with local faith-based groups to help Moses Cone Hospital in Greensboro come up with a streamlined process to show that someone is too sick to work and that other health systems could adopt. Their plan is to have a designated nurse oversee verifications relying on patients' electronic health records and a virtual visit to assess their current health and capacity for work. Foy's group can't be sure that Medicaid will accept that verification, and even if it does, it would take a lot of work to scale up across the state. This is very troubling, and we have to pivot very rapidly, Foy said. I've got a stack of my to-do things on my desk, but I have set them aside to get through this situation. Medicaid insurers can't do the verifications themselves, nor do they directly provide care, but private Medicaid-managed care plans, which have an interest in keeping qualified people covered, are preparing to do a lot of outreach and follow-up. Heidi Chan, president of AmeriHealth Caritas North Carolina, said administrators will use mail, emails, texts, and phone calls to alert people to the coming changes and what they need to do to stay covered. They will also offer in-person help via community educators and at the company's five regional community-based wellness and opportunity centers. Alliance Health is a non-profit Medicaid plan that covers people with physical, mental, or intellectual disabilities, including some covered under the expansion. Sarah Wilson, the plan's chief of staff, said they are determining which recipients to focus on and engagement strategies for a population that can be transient. Even with help from the plans, clinics, advocacy groups, and volunteers like Foy, officials and healthcare providers expect a steep climb to get everything in place by January the 1st. I think it's going to be a challenge, Bush said. Absolutely is going to be a challenge. Joanne Keenan, who wrote the article, has been a journalist in residence at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health since late 2021. Prior to joining Johns Hopkins, she oversaw health coverage at Politico, and she covered health for Reuters on Capitol Hill for more than a decade. Her most recent book is Information Sick: How Journalism's Decline and Misinformation's Rise Are Harming Our Health. Well, I hope you enjoyed those news updates. We have run out of time for today's episode of The Assembly. We hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to tune in next time. I am Naomi Lambert for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. This broadcast is now available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time, and if you have any questions or comments or requests, please contact us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. We so appreciate you listening each week, and we hope you enjoy learning more about what's going on in North Carolina.